One hates to say I told you so, but sometimes, like a month ago when one asked the Fed chair whether 0.75 percentage point was in play.
What you've seen is you've seen this committee adapt to the incoming data and the evolving outlook, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Well, told you so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 15th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, in a certain sense, what the Federal Reserve does is pretty straightforward.
We move the policy rate. That affects financial conditions, and that affects the economy.
In practice, of course, what Fed Chair Jay Powell was talking about there is a good deal more complicated.
Again, the overall exercise is that we try to provide as much clarity about our policy intentions as we can, because we think that makes monetary policy work better. It's always a trade-off, because you have to live with that guidance.
The Fed's guidance, of course, had been 0.5 percentage point interest rate increase. But after the inflation number last Friday and some indications that people have started expecting even higher inflation, Powell and the gang came out today and said, nope, 0.75 point right now. And you know what? Maybe 0.75 point again later on, too.
Inflation can't go down until it flattens out. And that's what we're looking to see. And if we don't see that, then that's the kind of thing that will cause, even if we don't see progress for a longer period, that could cause us to react.
The catch, of course, is that reacting, raising rates even more and slowing the economy, which is what the Fed is trying to do, right? That comes with a cost. And that cost is often people losing their jobs.
We don't seek to put people out of work. Of course, we never think too many people are working and fewer people need to have jobs. But we also think that you really cannot have the kind of labor market we want without price stability.
So here's where the Fed is right now as it looks for that price stability. But to paraphrase Mr. Powell, of course, this could change with new data. The central bank figures inflation's going to come down to 5.2% by the end of the year. It's 8.6% now. Unemployment's going to be at 3.7%. It's 3.6 now. And the federal funds rate, that is the rate the Fed controls, which sits at a range of 1.5% to 1.75% after today's hike, that federal funds rate is going to be on average at 3.4%. So up a bit. Next Fed meeting, last week of July. But let me back up here for a second, would you, to that whole slow the economy down thing. What that really means is to get consumers to spend less. Less consumer demand, prices stop going up, inflation backs off, and we are back to normal or close to it. One good proxy for consumer demand, in fact, maybe the best, retail sales, which we learned this morning, fell in May 0.3% from the reading in April. Now, in normal economic times, that would be unwelcome news, right? I think we can all agree, though, that these are not normal economic times. And in point of fact, what we might have here is the classic silver lining. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
So much can change in a year. For example, we spent $53 billion more dollars at stores and restaurants this May than we did last May. But you know where most of that $53 billion went?
Inflation.
Brett Ryan is senior U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank.
It's definitely a situation where consumers are paying more, but they're purchasing less.
For example, just from April to May, we spent 4% more at gas stations. But the price of gas went up 8%. Paying more, getting less. But turns out the American consumer isn't taking that lying down.
They absolutely are moderating their behavior.
Claire Tassin is with Morning Consult. We are cutting our spending a little on things we don't need or big purchases we can delay.
Motor vehicle sales and electronics and home furnishings are where we're starting to see consumers make those trade-offs.
Tassin says we're also starting to buy smaller packages, lean into cheaper store brand products. We bought less online in May, too. Vivek Pandya is chief insights analyst with Adobe, which tracks online sales.
This is likely an early indicator that growth is going to continue to slow and consumers are going to continue to pull back.
And that pulling back may be exactly what the economy needs. Again, Claire Tassin.
we are already starting to see a softening of consumers experiencing delays or unavailable products. So the softening of demand is helping to alleviate the supply chain challenge, which then helps to alleviate the inflation challenge.
But she says that will take some time to play out. Inflation in May was 8.6%. That's not going to vaporize overnight. And so far, we've been talking about goods. There's still a lot of pent-up demand for services. That inflation has been mostly getting worse the past 6 months. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
I texted a buddy of mine who works in finance today before the Fed's interest rate came out. 50 or 75, I said. That's basis points, 0.5% or 0.75. No sooner had I hit send than 75 came back the answer. Markets will tank if only 50, he said. Reader, the markets did not tank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House has clearly decided it's kind of done with big oil. President Biden has sent a letter to the big refiners, ExxonMobil and Chevron among them, telling them they have got to do something to lower the price of gas and diesel. Biden said what he called historically high refinery profit margins are not acceptable. That's a quote. We also got some data from the International Energy Agency this morning that is not going to help at all. Oil demand, the IEA says, is going to outpace supply into next year, and it's going to be that way as long as the Russian war in Ukraine lasts. Marketplace's Andy Euler has today's crude recap.
Predicting energy demand into next year is no easy task, says Joseph Sikora. He's an equity analyst at Aptus Capital Advisors.
I think it's very difficult to have any forecast whatsoever for 2023 for a number of reasons.
He says those include rising interest rates, inflation, and potential lockdowns in places like China if there are COVID flare-ups. But in the very short term, things are a little clearer. Geopolitics and supply chain hiccups are limiting supply, while in the U.S., it's driving in vacation season, which means we're burning a lot of fuel. Abhi Rajendran is research director at Energy Intelligence.
It's not end consumers that buy oil. It's refineries that buy oil, and refineries have never made so much money. And so oil demand is going to be very robust over the short term, even with the global kind of economic picture looking pretty dicey.
He says if refineries could process more oil right now, they would. Hugh Daigle at the University of Texas says any request from the White House to do more is likely going to get a shoulder shrug from refiners.
Refiners are operating, you know, near capacity, 90 to 95% capacity. There's not much more capacity they can add. And so you can tell them, please produce more gasoline. But it's more complicated than that.
He says that limited refining capacity could just be a new reality. Many refineries were shut down during the pandemic, and investors are no longer keen on long-term capital-intensive fossil fuel projects here in the U.S. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Continuing now with a theme of high demand and low supply, if your business, oh, say putting out a magazine, requires paper, these are challenging times. Claudia Smuckler is the production director at Mother Jones, which means it's her responsibility to get the magazine printed and distributed, about which, by the way, she wrote a story for the magazine. So we got her on the phone to talk about the state of magazine production here in pandemic times. Claudia, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So what's it like these days being production director at a magazine?
Yeah, it's very volatile these days. a lot of changes going on. Nothing is a given.
And you had a particular challenge back in March and April, right? About getting, and the amount of paper that's involved is staggering. 70,000 pounds of paper was going to be late, and you needed it, and you couldn't get it?
Well, the way we purchase paper is we like to have, you know, one on press, you know, an order on press, some in the warehouse and some at the mill being made at the time. So we have a flow of paper. And the last couple of years, there's been a lot of disruptions on that. So sometimes we can't get our full allocation of 70,000 pounds that we need for one issue. Also, there have been delays from the transportation sector that moves materials around. And the mills have had difficulty keeping up with some of the demand that has come back since the pandemic.
We should be clear here. When we talk paper for magazines, we're not talking the same kind of stuff that we use or used to use, I guess, in the office printer, the 8.5 by 11. There's grades and weights, and it's not the same, and you need different things for different kinds of images and all of that?
Well, it's pretty complex, but basically it's like a giant size roll of toilet paper, but a very specific kind that's coated and ink lays on well on that paper. But it is something that we specifically order for our publication. The presses that we run and the quantity and page count that we run.
So obviously the supply chain being a mess for the last 2.5 years is the proximate cause of this. But I wonder how much of your paper challenge is a result of the move to digital and thus an overall need for less magazine grade paper and then probably fewer mills putting it out and thus your supply challenged to begin with.
You're right. I think there's a historical, a shrinking demand for publication grades papers. And there are fewer mills that are making that than 10 years ago. Certainly the pandemic came along with lots of disruptions. But the, post-pandemic, I think one of the things that is aggravating the situation right now is that magazines and catalogs, which use the same kind of paper as magazines, have come back pretty strong. And it's maybe surprised the mills, or the mills have decided that publication papers is shrinking. So they're moving to convert some of their paper machines over to packaging and some of the other grades that seem to be growing these days.
I imagine you're bullish on the print magazine industry, given your line of work.
Well, yes, I am. And I think print is really resilient. While we maybe have 9 million page views a month across all those platforms, the 185,000 print subscribers are our strongest supporters.
Claudia Smuckler, she's a production director at Mother Jones. It's her job to get that magazine out on the paper. Claudia, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
No, definitely not. It's too complicated.
All right, then. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 303 today, 1%, 30,668. The NASDAQ jumped 270 points, about 2.5%, 11,099. S&P 500 lifted 54 points, 1.4%, 37.89 there. Heard from Sabri about retail sales down in May. So, some retail stocks. Target found 3.3% today. Kohl's up 4.1%. Wayfair ordered up 3.1% today. And Euler did oil. So in refinery stocks today, Marathon Petroleum down about 3.7%. Phillips 66 down 1.7%. Valero Energy dropped just over 4% today. Meta, that is still honestly Facebook to most of us, has expanded its parental controls for Instagram, which it owns. It also rolled out its first tools for supervising virtual reality. Meta gained 3.4% today. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes.
Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Department of Education announced last week that it's appointing its first ever chief economist. The agency says it wants more data-based approaches to making policy, and economists, most of them anyway, are pretty good at sifting through all that data. The Department of Education, though, has been around for more than 40 years. So what took them so long? Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that history lesson.
Part of Jimmy Carter's 1976 presidential campaign was making education a national priority.
We can have an America that provides excellence in education to my child and your child and every child.
Once elected, he made education its own cabinet department. Stuart E. Eisenstadt, who was Carter's chief domestic policy advisor, says the president had lots of goals for the agency, economic and otherwise.
Remember, he grew up in the segregated South. It was to be an integrative situation where people of different ethnic and racial backgrounds could work together in a school structure.
After four decades, the agency has access to a lot of data. And as the department's brand new chief economist, Jordan Matsudaira says it's time to leverage that information.
I think building this team is just kind of recognition of our need to really have kind of better analytic firepower.
But policymakers still have to pay attention to what they can't easily analyze, says John Vallant, who directs the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution.
When we focus too much on creating policies that perform well on the things we can measure, we tend to get tunnel vision and not do in schools the kind of things that we need to do to make sure that we're satisfying all of the different goals of education.
Vallant notes it's a lot easier to measure things like math and reading, which are necessary for a healthy economy, but a lot harder to measure skills like kindness and understanding, which are necessary for a healthy democracy. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We talked Powell and jobs earlier, and look, we know that the labor market now is so different than it was back in the before times. And one big way is that people have started thinking it might be time for a career change, just doing something new. Catherine Fink is one of those people. She's been a teacher for 18 years. She lives in Longmont, Colorado, and she decided she wanted to go to law school. We first talked to her last summer. So we got her back on the phone the other day to hear how year one of law school went while she was teaching at the same time.
I think it was the hardest year, I don't want to say ever, because when we had three kids under three, that was really rough too. But it was definitely the year that I felt the most frazzled, just in terms of having to be basically at three full-time jobs, it felt like. So, you know, teaching high school English, going to law school part-time, and then having three kids. I did really well the first semester, and I was really proud of myself, but then I just had such like a sleep deficit. I started having anxiety and insomnia. I realized that for my mental health and to be somewhat successful as a parent and teacher, I had to cut back second semester. So I stopped getting up so early in the morning and stopped studying after the kids' bedtime. And I just got my grades back and I did fine. So I did have a scholarship, but I still had to take out some student loans. I probably didn't take out quite enough of student loans because we found ourselves a little underwater. But part of that was also that things got a lot more expensive this year. I think we ended up eating a lot more takeout, partially because we were just exhausted. So that certainly ate into our budget, if you will. I had thought about seeing if I could quit teaching and maybe just tutor or something like that, but financially it just seems impossible. So financially we're going to be in the hole for another couple of years. We just have to take it year by year at this point and dip into our savings if we need to. I do feel like it's worth it. I mean, it's very exciting to be challenged intellectually as an adult, especially after the ins and outs of teaching and parenting and pandemicking and adulting that, you know, are not inspiring in that same way. My own kids, you know, are really proud of me, and I think that's special to have that role in their life, like someone who shows them that they can be whoever they want to be no matter how old they are. They can reinvent themselves. I'm ready for the next thing, and whatever that is, I feel good about bringing this new set of skills that I'll have in addition to my skills I've developed as a teacher. So I hope I can be an asset to whatever community I serve eventually using my JD.
Catherine Fink, law student, high school teacher, mom of three in Longmont, Colorado. Now that the UK is out of the European Union, there is a whole slew of EU rules and regulations that the Brits are thinking about getting out from under. For one thing, being in the EU meant that the UK had to go metric, meters and kilometers and kilograms, right? And get rid of imperial measurements, feet and inches, pounds and ounces, pints and gallons. Being out of the EU has the British government talking about going imperial again. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been measuring the mood in the city of Shrewsbury, home, as it happens, to one of the UK's best-known metric skeptics.
74-year-old Tony Bennett is a self-confessed saboteur. Over the decades, he's launched many daring raids across the UK after loading up his car with a small armoury.
We need a screwdriver to get some of them off. Hammer comes in handy occasionally for bashing a few things. And a pair of pliers is sometimes necessary as well to...
Bennett and his friends have waged a long campaign against metric road signs, dismantling and replacing or amending them to show miles instead of kilometres.
It's not that we hate the metric signs, but we just want to keep those ones we're familiar with. Ultimately, this is a campaign more about the preservation of our culture and identity.
Bennett's largely won that battle, partly because of his campaign. Metric road signs never became mandatory in the UK. But the road sign warrior and the British government have their beady eyes on another vestige of EU membership. Most goods and services sold here must still use metric weights and measures, infringing, as he sees it, a fundamental right.
We'd like to be able to go into a shop and order our cheese and our fruit and our meat in ounces and have it weighed in ounces.
So what's the general feeling about this? I've come to a butcher's stall in a market in Shrewsbury to find out how much appetite is there for reverting to imperial. Butcher William Dodd.
I'm happy with how we do it now, you know, in kilos and everything else. When you've got four or five scales, then you've got to have them converted back. You spend maybe £2,000 or £3,000 on scales.
Oh, right, so you'd rather stick with the metric system?
Financially wise for me, yes.
The main business organisations agree. They say giving more official prominence to imperial measures will create cost and confusion and push up prices. But Georgiana and Stephen Williams, who run this butcher's stall on the other side of the market, take the opposite view.
Personally, I think it's a good idea to go back to the pounds and ounces.
Why?
Because a lot of our customers still ask for stuff in pounds and ounces rather than grams.
You ask most people what something is, how tall they are. They don't say I'm 200 centimetres. Even youngsters say I'm 6 foot. It won't cause any confusion anyway, because most people haven't really changed.
Like customer Tom James, for example.
I'd rather have the pounds and ounces. We should have never changed in the first place.
But don't you think the metric system makes more sense? I mean, 16 ounces to the pound, 14 pounds to the stone, 8 stone to 100 weight, 20 100 weight to a ton. It's a mess,
no,
isn't it? But
no, not really, because I think it makes you use your brains.
Not, however, an argument that persuades another shopper here, Chris Williams, who isn't keen on the imperial system.
No, definitely not. It's too complicated.
And Bob Burns, who prefers the metric system for professional reasons.
I am an engineer. From an engineering point of view, it is metric and it's got to be metric and metric's correct, OK? The only thing I'm in favour of, really, in the imperial system is a pint of beer.
In fact, the EU allowed the UK, when it was a member, to use the imperial system for draft beer, milk in returnable containers and road signs. And imperial equivalents could be displayed alongside the metric measurements. Today, many Brits use both systems and at the same time. Supporters of the status quo say this preserves a key characteristic of British culture, muddle. In Shrewsbury, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tell you what, I never did understand that stone thing, man. Always threw me. Anyway, this final note on the way out today, just because it can be good sometimes to take a minute and look back. So after the increase today, the federal funds rate sits in a range of 1.5% to 1.75%, right? You know where it was at the last Fed meeting in the before times, before everything went south? 1.5% to 1.75%. Where it is today? History matters, y'all. Even recent history. All right, here's your moment of economic context, just because we haven't checked crude in a while, and also bearing in mind what Euler was talking about a couple of minutes ago. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down about 0.7% today, $118.93. a barrel. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.